Good morning. I think we're going to start this little discussion that we have. It's a very nice format for discussion between people. We keep the same attitude that we had yesterday, that's very relaxed and informal and somehow civilized. A little change in the program today. This afternoon, take good note of that. This afternoon, there will be no coffee break, okay? So we start at 2 p.m. with Alfonso and then Magdalena at 2:45. And there was a mistake. So in fact, at 5:30, we shall have Thomas Brown. And I will end at 6:15 so that everything is finished at 5 p.m. And I will ask the administration, est-ce qu'on peut avoir la pause café à 5 heures? Oui. So when we leave at 5 p.m., you will have a coffee after, if you wish, okay? If not, there are plenty of bars around for whiskeys and beers and something more, entertaining that the good coffee of the Collège de France. Okay. So with these words, I'm happy to welcome Simone. And Simone, you're here, right?
Yeah.
And you're going to tell us about the immune neuronal crosstalk for axonal regeneration.
Thank you very much to the organizers. It's been really a wonderful symposium in a great city, nice weather, so all good. Thank you. What you see here, yesterday you heard talk about NADPH oxidase, NOX signaling. What you see here in red is active NOX2 complex following sciatic nerve injury. I would like to thank two people, starting from the bottom, who's not in my lab anymore, but has done most of the work I will present on NOX signaling. And Luming has done most of the work I will present on T cells and axonal injury, while Tom has done most of the work I will show you on environmental enrichment. And thanks to some key collaborators for NOX and for immune regulation of axonal regeneration and to some of the key funders. What we're interested in is the try to understand why axons stemming from postmitotic neurons in the adult or in the age do not regenerate following injury. An example is shown here, a few examples. One, these are corticospinal tract. This is spinal cord injury in a mouse. You see the corticospinal tract do not regrow. These are sensory axons coming from dorsal root ganglia. That's what I'm going to talk about today mostly. This is a spinal cord injury, and you see they do not grow past the lesion. Then here, it's a sciatic nerve. Again, sensory axons here. The cut and the reanastomosis, and there is poor regeneration in this model, where you will see there is some level of regeneration where you do have a crush injury. It's been shown that axonal...
question for those of us who are not very versed in this field. When you make the cut, when you make the injury,
yeah,
the axons retract, I mean the tracts retract, and then they grow up to the area.
That's correct. Yeah, and in some cases, it's a good question. You will see later in the aged animals, and it's believed in humans, this retraction is not followed by regrowth to in proximity of the lesion site. That's what happens in the young, typically. Yeah. Thank you. So, yes, this was supposed to be later, but it doesn't matter. This is just to say that most of the axonal and spinal injury have a wave of increased incidence, that is, peaks with young age and then peaks again in the old. And this is not always very well recognized. And this kind of increase of injuries, traumatic injuries mainly, what we're talking about in the old, is probably partially due to the fact that we have an aging population and which is more active and more fit in many ways, but at the same time, of course, can incur in a higher level of traumatic injuries. What is important, I will show you in a later slide, is to consider that the axonal regenerative capacity in postmitotic neurons declines with maturation, meaning that during embryonic development, the extending neurons before reaching a synaptic target after injury has a very good capacity to regenerate. Early postnatally, when they reach their target, they make a synapse, there is a window where there is also still a good capacity to regrow, although it's lower compared to embryonic development. In the young, there's a very limited capacity to regenerate. And in the old, talking about mammals and humans, in the aged, this drops again. So it's kind of a stepwise decline in regenerative ability, and the mechanisms are probably multiple. What I will talk about today is the dorsal root ganglia system. Dorsal root ganglia are sensory axons that are located on the side of the spinal cord. They have a number of different neurons that are important to convey cutaneous and proprioceptive sensory information from the periphery, to the central nervous system through the spinal cord, running into different systems in the spinal cord, depending whether they convey sensory information of different kinds or nociceptive information, because in here are also nociceptive neurons. What is particularly interesting as far as regeneration is concerned is the fact that if you lesion the peripheral branch, this is followed by increased signaling and axonal transport that leads to enhancement of the regenerative gene expression program. This signaling and the regenerative expression program, however, fails when we cut the central branch of the spinal cord, and this has led to a number of interesting findings to trying to understand the molecular basis of regenerative failure. Today, I will show you data on both peripheral lesions that, as I said, they do mount a regenerative program. However, the full regenerative capacity is still very incomplete, and central lesions in the spinal cord of sensory axons. And we will focus mostly our attention on sensory neurons on the cell bodies as signaling at that level, although not only. So a few more, this is just a reminder of what I just told you about sensory neurons. And what is also interesting, I mentioned yesterday during discussion, is that enhancement of sensory afferents into the spinal cord seems to contribute to reshaping of motor circuitry and to functional recovery, including motor recovery, via mechanism that are still partially, largely not understood. Last but not least, I want to mention how nerve injury in the periphery is very commonly associated not only to traumatic, but also to metabolic disease, autoimmune diseases, and others like drug-induced disorders. So they're really very common in the population. So there's a big need for this to be addressed. What happens following, what happens following axonal injury? This is just a big overview, but I think it's quite nice. And now here I'm addressing what was asked just earlier. So following an axonal injury, of course, there is Wallerian degeneration, axons die back. And then in a later phase, this is a dorsal root ganglia, there's the regenerative response starts and it fails or succeeds more or less, depending upon a number of different factors. Definitely, the immune system here summarized with all the different cell types, including innate and adaptive immunity, play a major role, obviously, following injury. Therefore, definitely cannot be ignored. A few years ago, I wondered what were the common features of this increase in inflammatory response that we know has dichotomic role, meaning that it's needed to enhance regenerative signaling, but it's needed also to destroy the injured axon, right? So a common thread of all of this was increasing reactive oxygen species. And what was also particularly interesting, discussed yesterday, is the ROS, and specifically the signal neurons, which is H2O2, are needed for developmental axonal growth. Therefore, we set out to ask the question of whether reactive oxygen species, in particular H2O2, would be important to contribute to axonal outgrowth and regeneration in vivo, whether they could travel from the injury site to the cell body and maybe back, and what could be the specific ROS-dependent signal. I will show you some key data because this data has been published last year, but I thought it's quite interesting also in the context of the later discussion that we will have. Before going into it, just a reminder of NOX signaling. I love this cartoon that from Holstrom and Finkel a few years ago. I think it's beautiful. And that's why I'm going to show it, although yesterday you saw a cartoon about NOX. And this shows how the transmembrane NOX complex, there are a number of isoforms, but it doesn't matter right now, produces H2O2, as yesterday shown to you on the extracellular side, and then aquaporin channels allow H2O2 to go inside and inside the cell and oxidize cysteines, the methionine. If you look here, that is what I like the most. Basically, when you look at redox signaling, you can pretend this is phosphorylation, acetylation, any post-acetylational modification will result in any of this classical fundamental signaling purposes and changes. So just keep this in mind. This is a very nice review if you want. Now it's a little dated, but it's a very nice review if you're interested in this. So going to the summary of what we found out, following axonal injury, we found an increase in CX3CL1, which is an important chemokine to attract a number of cells, including neutrophils and macrophages. And among other cells, macrophages are activated towards the attracted towards the injury site, expressing appropriate receptors. And this leads to the release in exosomes of an active, I'll show you some evidence for that, NOX2 complex, then by a dynamine-dependent endocytic mechanism is incorporated within the axon, within endosomes, and probably, we don't have very clear evidence for this, probably there's a flipping during the incorporation endosomes of the NOX2 complex, which is then transported by a retrograde mediated mechanism, both in protein B1 dependent and dynein dependent, that is what we tested, within RAB7 late endosomes. Well, we also found that within the endosome, there is expression of SOD1, which is essential, as summarized yesterday, of course, to dismutase H2O2. And during the travel from the injury site to the cell body, there is an oxidation of P10, obviously among others, but for some reason, for different reasons, I don't have time to explain to you now, we focused on this, that leads to inactivation of P10 itself, leading to activation of phospho-AKT and then regenerative gene expression. Phospho-AKT and partially mTOR, they're quite important signaling pathways. They're very profoundly affected during development and during aging. I will go back to phospho-AKT later. Here are some of the key data. One of the first interesting observations was that we saw very early on, about 2 hours following injury, the accumulation of a regulatory subunit of the NOX2 complex within axons following sciatic injury. And this kind of ruled out the transcriptional dependent mechanisms because of the time and made us think that maybe NOX2 was coming out from somewhere from outside. And obviously, it was not difficult to imagine that immune cells were loaded with NOX2. And another important piece of evidence was when we found that active phosphorylated regulatory subunit of NOX2 was indeed expressed within RAB7 positive vesicles. So that's a bona fide marker of late endosomes. Another important piece of evidence was to find that H2O2, as detected by this dye, was actively produced within these endosomes. And therefore, I had at the time the impression that maybe we had like a comet. I had this in my mind traveling from the lesion site towards the cell body and then having around this little cloud of reactive H2O2 that would, of course, go across membranes of endosomes based upon the model the others have discovered before me, of course. And this was further supported by experiments where we injected a retrograde tracer in the sciatic nerve at the time of injury, and then we used either importing three specific axonal knockout mice to inhibit importin-dependent retrograde transport, or we used cyanobravin D, which is a dynein inhibitor, also inhibiting retrograde transport. And then immediately after we did sciatic nerve axotomy, and then we looked at dorsal root ganglia where the cell body is, and we looked at NOX, active NOX, and H2O2. Sorry, no, in this case we looked mainly at superoxide. And basically what we found is following sciatic nerve injury, we have increase in superoxide in wild type mice. This is strongly decreased with importing. In importing knockout mice, and similar data are found with cyanobravin D, so with inhibition of dynein. And this is just to show you when we measured also the expression of the active regulatory subunit of NOX2 complex, this is to show you the decrease in the expression as a matter of time and the distance from the lesion site to the dorsal root ganglia, supporting what I've shown you in the cartoon. Another important piece of evidence was the fact that we indeed found already active NOX2 in exosomes. So they were already charged with active NOX2. NOX2 did not need to be necessarily activated within axons, although, of course, it's interesting to speculate that you will need probably some maintenance of the activation of NOX2 within axons to have maybe, you know, long-term axonal regeneration. And the evidence was when we looked at the summoned subunits of NOX2 complex and their active form in macrophages following activation with LPS plus and in exosomes. Of course, what was important here, there are some markers for exosomes and some markers for non-exosomes, kind of as a control here. That's what you can see here. We don't need to go into details. And it was also interesting to see at electron microscopy that a critical subunit P22 or NOX2 complex was indeed expressed in exosomes by EM. Last but not least, we found an active RAC1 GTP complex in exosomes, which is an essential step into the activation of NOX2 complex. So indeed, NOX2 complex was active within exosomes. And another important experiment was when we measured NOX activity, and this is Ajay's lab in King's that did this measure NOX activity for us. That was very useful in wild-type mice following in exosomes. And when we have the knockout for two subunits of the NOX2 complex, NOX2 proper, the structure, and this is a regulatory subunit, this activity was strongly impaired. And interesting, when we delivered exosomes on top of neurons, I don't have time to show you other experiments, but this promoted outgrowth, and this was blocked when active NOX2 was not present due to the deletion of critical subunits. Last piece of data I'm going to show you about this story is was something that was really, I think, nice to see. When we overexpress one subunit, NCF1, this is a gene. I apologize, but I'm trying to follow the nomenclature, you know, very scientifically, but it's a little confusing because the protein is P47 and the gene is NCF1. So it's the same guy that you saw at the beginning in the of the talk. And when we electroporated this subunit on OX2 complex with GFP in macrophages, and then we cultured macrophages on the axonal compartment in these chambers that divide axonal body from the axon. We saw, first of all, here accumulation expression of the NOX2 subunit in macrophages. This is just the control. And down here, we see that this experiment led to the incorporation of GFP positive signal in the cell body of neurons as well as in the axon. And this mechanism and this incorporation was dependent upon dynamine, as shown by dinosaur inhibition that reduced both the incorporation and neurite outgrowth, as shown here in the graph, mediated by delivery of extracellular, in terms of neuron, NOX2 subunit. So this suggests that NOX2 subunit overexpressed in macrophages is released following activation of macrophages. It goes into the axon and travels back to the cell body. And this is the summary. And I didn't have time to show you the, all of these events, cellular and signaling events that are summarized in the cartoon, are indeed important for axonal regeneration of both the peripheral nerve and the central sensory projection into the spinal cord. We have, and I'm going to show you this because I particularly like, the color is not right. Anyways, I particularly like this cartoon that I now did, and it's going to come out in next month in the Transient Cell Biology as a cover, where you see a macrophage that cures different tissues with reactive oxygen species. And here we discuss a number of developmental as well as post-injury paracrine mechanisms that contribute to tissue regeneration. We discuss bone, heart, and nervous system. We wrote this in collaboration with Ajay at King's. So if you want to have a look at that. Now we switch gear a little bit, and this I wanted to put this earlier, but I think it's fine here as well. And this slide just summarizes what I told you earlier about this regenerative decline and stepwise decline in the regenerative capacity. And that is what I'm going to address now in the last part of my talk. Very short intro that allows me to explain to you how we got into T-cell signaling in the aged. And we've been struggling in the last few years to try to modulate the axonal regenerative program via injury-independent mechanisms. Just because so far injury-dependent mechanisms have been very useful to instruct regenerative strategies, but they haven't had full success. So in a way, it's kind of serendipity kind of approach. Let's see what else we can find, and which is injury-independent. And indeed, we found, and this also has been published last month. So I will just summarize this data very briefly. We found that if we put mice in environmental enrichment. Again, I apologize, projects very, very light, but meaning putting mice in larger cages with toys and tunnels and swings and so on, that leads to an increase in neuronal activity of sensory neurons, leading then to changes in histone acetylation and epigenetic activation that allows long-term regeneration of sensory neurons. Now, this is shown here, for example, when you look at a sciatic nerve crush, we have more regeneration when we put mice in a rich environment before an injury. So it's a priming mechanism. And the same happens when you do cut and reanastomosis of the sciatic nerve. And similarly, when we look at sensory axons in the spinal cord, this is the normal retraction that they have in the young here. This is some level of regeneration they have with the conditioning lesion, so when we cut the peripheral branch, it's known that this promotes some regenerative program, as I told you earlier. Then when we put mice in a rich environment before the lesion, we have increasing regeneration that is further potentiated by associating this peripheral lesion with the rich environment. So all of this made us think, based upon data that shown that in rich environment, leads to some benefit in aged mice from different perspectives, broadly speaking. We thought that using environmental enrichment in the aged mice might induce positive epigenetic changes in dorsal ganglia and promote axonal regeneration. Maybe you could identify novel targets for therapy, as we did here. I didn't have the time to show you. But as you will see, the RNA-seq data spoke very differently and led us into a totally different direction. All right, so initial experiments. Again, this is now a sciatic nerve. It's a sciatic nerve crush. Up here, you see a staining for regenerative sensory axon. Up here, you have physiological regeneration at 3 days in the young animal, meaning 2-3 months. This is lack of this regenerative capacity or decrease in regenerative capacity in the old mouse, meaning this is about 22 months old, so really old. And this is pre-exposure of 10 days of enriched environment in the young. This is basically just confirming previous data from other people in the lab. And this is enriched environment in the old. As you can see, enriched environment in the old mimics the young in SH means standard housing. You will see this throughout now the next slide in the last part of my talk. SH, standard housing, EE, enriched environment, before an injury. And this is another way to look at axonal regeneration. We inject a tracer in distally to the lesion in the nerve, and then we look, basically you count in the dorsal root ganglia the number of neurons that are positive for the tracer, and this data is supportive of this. So it's just a reiteration of that data, just with another technique. And we have similar effects with spinal cord injury as well. Now, we took now the sciatic dorsal root ganglia. This was quite early on, 1 day following injury in the young versus old with appropriate control, meaning before injury, standard housings versus enriched environment. The goal here was what can be the molecular substrate and the mechanism allowing this regenerative rejuvenation, if you allow me the popular terminology, of enriched environment upon axonal regeneration. And RNA-seq data, I will now explain what this is, spoke very loudly, unlike all of my previous RNA-seq data. And what's shown here is, again, the colors are not, it's not white here, for some reason it comes out white, but anyways, the message is there. This is 24 hours following axotomy, dorsal root ganglia RNA-seq, in the young. This is the old, and this is the old following a rich environment, all compared to appropriate injury controls, of course. And what you see here is upregulated genes follow in the old, following injury, they are strongly downregulated in by environmental enrichment. And what you see here is basically a unanimous classification of immune regulation. In particular, there is a prominence of T cells. Among other immune cells here. In the down-regulated genes, interestingly, and particularly because of this community and the topic that I'm not addressing fully today, is the fact that the down-regulated genes in the old following axotomy compared to the young that are reversed by enriched environment are mainly associated to developmental programs. And here we are in the periphery. A lot of this gene ontology talks about muscle and so on, but it's just gene ontology. Yeah, so, you know, it's just solved. But this is straight off the gene ontology, so we haven't edited that. But so basically, it looks like that aging, and it's not surprising, decreases these developmental processes that in a rich environment is able to enhance. Potentially, and we haven't addressed this, but I think it's fascinating, letting us ask the question of whether maybe T signaling might have a role on reversing developmental deterioration of developmental programs, maybe. And very partially, we'll see it later. Now, going to the more now granular analysis of specific genes that are significantly changed with age, they are reversed by environmental enrichment with a 1.5-fold change, and they're all in the upregulated side. We see here what I'm talking about, gene ontology, lymphocyte, T cell very predominant, and when you do KEK pathways, you see that it's a lot of immune-dependent pathways. When we look, okay, so just before I now go into dwell into the data, I just want to give you a sense with one badly pasted from the internet, you see, from the quality, I apologize, to have an idea of what is that we know about T cells and aging. What we know basically is there is a maladaptive response of T cells, meaning that there is mainly an impoverishment of naive T cell population, so they're actually lower in terms of counting in numbers, but there is an expansion of tissue resident T regulatory cells that people believe in different contexts, nothing is known in what I'm showing you now, might contribute to a more aggressive signaling following injury in the age versus the young. What the gene network analysis shows here, again from those, that this is a close-up of that cluster of 166 genes. Very clearly we see that there is a T-cell receptor activation cluster here, mainly CD8, that is associated with the CD8 T-cell chemotaxis kind of cluster. Now, yeah, I've highlighted some proteins. I'm going to go through them briefly. And very interesting, we have CXCL13 and CXCR5. These were confirmed also by ELISA at the protein level, some of these key members that are important. CXCL13 is a chemokine that attracts CXCR5 cells. There is a subset of T cells that express CXCR5, and there are also express the T cell, they're associated, sorry, with the T cell priming markers in antigen-presenting cells. The ERGs are known largely to be actually neurons themselves. We also have CXCR3 receptor, which interestingly is expressed also in CXCR5 T cells, and we have also the expression of the ligand for this receptor. So all in all, what this network speaks in favor of is the potential age-dependent upregulation of this cluster, of this specific subset of T cells. I will tell you a little bit more about who they are, because they've been discovered actually several years ago, not very long ago, and nothing is known in injury conditions, or in particular the DIGs. And this is just further confirmation of what I'm telling you about. I will summarize in this cartoon the data that I will show you, because I think it's quite helpful, also allows me to maybe, you know, shortcut some of the data. So this is the dorsal root ganglia in the aged. We found that there's an activation of TNF signaling and the receptor that leads to activation of IKK-dependent activation of NFL-kappa-B2 in particular that gets phosphorylated and activates that chemokine I mentioned earlier, CXCL13, which is expressed in neurons, accumulates in the cytoplasm, it's released in the extracellular space, and leads to the attraction of T lymphocytes that are already there, as you will see, with age in the DRG, probably because of leaky Brabham barrier tight junctions. Injury now, so this is all before injury in the age. Injury leads to MHC class 1, a number of antigen processing mechanisms that is known injury leads to, that then is presented by neurons and that attracts T cells, leading to the activation of classical signaling, most likely, we only partially investigate that, with perforin granzyme B, that leads to the activation of caspase 3 that truncates AKT, shown previously, leading to AKT reduction of AKT phosphorylation and reduction of S6 phosphorylation, which is the mTOR pathway. And this is the pathway that we also found following you know, NOx2 signaling to be important for axonal generation of sensory neurons. Some of the key data here show you that CXCL13 expression in neurons in the old versus the young before injury is already very high. And this is also after injury, and shown here. In rich environment, strongly decreases the activation of CXCL13 in neurons. However, at the injury site, CXCL13 is expressed also in axons, but does not change with age or injury. So we think the mechanisms is actually relies on cell body dependent activation. Number of potential mechanisms have been suggested by others in different cells to activate CXCL13. And this, we looked again at our RNA-seq data, and our RNA-seq data suggests that NFA-kappa-B signaling is activated, in particular B2 is significant, while this is increased but not significantly, is activated in the old versus the young following injury and decreased by a rich environment. For this reason, and knowing that IKK kinase is a key regulatory mechanism to activate NFA-kappa-B, we investigated whether CXCL13 was indeed activated by TNF that we found increase in aging, not surprisingly, and IKK-dependent mechanisms that lie downstream TNF signaling. This has been shown already. And I will just skip this, and this is in vitro. Let's go to the in vivo data. Basically, both Western blotting and RT-PCR show that following sciatic nerve injury in the young or in the old, that's the comparison, young, old, we found an increase in CXCL13 expression, which is dependent upon IKK by using the specific IKK inhibitor, suggesting that NFA-kappa-B also phosphorylated form is overexpressed in the old following injury, is an important step into the signaling mechanisms. More data, I don't have time to show you about this now. When we antagonize CXCL13 with monoclonal antibodies by injecting in vivo immediately after an injury and day two, and then we look at DRG regenerative growth at day three, we see that CXCL13 antagonism promotes regrowth of sensory neurons in vitro and regeneration in vivo to a similar level in the old to what we find in the young in versus that they've been treated with control IgG. Interesting, CXCL13 antagonism does not have any synergistic addictive effect in promoting regrowth in the young. And indeed, in the young, CXCL13 is not upregulated. When we use CXCL13 antibody neutralization, we observe that CD8 T cells that accumulate in the DRGs of the old are strongly reduced. And caspase 3 activation, which is increased in the old, is also strongly reduced following CXCL13 activation. Who are these T cells? When we, based upon the network I told you, we try to characterize with a number of co-immunolabeling, and we also do in FACS now, and we find that these are T cells, they're actually very small, but now this is a high magnification compared to neurons. And you see that in the old here, compared to the young, there are already T cells inside the DRGs. They're there, waiting, perhaps, that's what we think, to be activated by an injury, sciatic nerve axotomy, that allows antigen-presenting mechanisms to the T cells. And this increase in T cells that are, this is high magnification, mainly CXCR5 positive, is reduced by environmental enrichment. And this is validation of that network that I showed you based upon RNA-seq. The last 3-4 minutes, I just want to tell you a little bit more about the signaling and what are the CXCR5 CD8 T cells. They're follicular T cells that have the capacity to self-renew much more than other active T cells. What happens, active T cells are led to exhaustion very quickly. It's an immune regulatory mechanism. These cells hang around much longer. They have powerful effects in terms of activating also B cell recruitment and antibody production. So, of course, there is much crosstalk in the immune system. And they've been found to be in follicles several years ago, but they haven't been described really post-injury, but they've been found to be potentially activated in cancer or in autoimmunity, and potentially to limit cancer and autoimmunity by attacking target cells. Here just the evidence of the MHC class 1. You all know this is very basic. So basically, T cell engages with an MHC1 cluster presented by antigen-presenting cells, and then the releases, of course, the its granzymes and perforin, and not always, but in many cases, that kills the infected cell. What we see here is MHC class 1. It's better visible in the old after injury. You see, this is only in the membrane. These are neurons. See, MHC class 1, this is the membrane staining. And MHC class 1 is indeed mainly activated by injury in the old. So that is the most important injury-dependent mechanism, while a lot of what we've seen is already present there in the old. And when we deplete CD8 cells, shown here the depletion in the spleen and the lymph nodes, we see a reduction of CD8 T cells. This is the real kind of magnification you see in neurons. You see small T cells. And as expected, more importantly, when we look at axonal regeneration, we see that CD8 depletion versus IgG increases axonal regeneration in the old. This is all 3 days for sciatic nerve crush. In vitro, if we take activated T cells, we activate them in specific classical ways, and then we see that they lead to decrease in axonal growth, increase in caspase 3, but there was no change in cell death. Indeed, in vivo, more importantly, we look, again, look maybe down here, it's easier. So again, this is active caspase 3 staining, and we see that caspase 3 is strongly induced in the old after injury only. And this is decreased by enriched environment. It does not lead to apoptosis, shown here, as opposed to DNase 1 control where you see apoptotic nuclei. This is just to probably in 2019, I don't have to convince you of non-apoptotic caspase 3 signaling. You all know that it's very important, caspase 3, it's important to cleave NANOC, and therefore, for example, it's important for cell reprogramming. Or it's important for axonal pruning. It also plays an important role in cleaving some specific actin-associated proteins, and therefore has a role in morphogenesis during development. So there are plenty of roles that are non-apoptotic for caspases. And this is the last two slides I have, where I will show you how CD8 T cell depletion leads to, down here, reduction in Cleaves caspase 3 signaling, and increase in phospho-AKT and phospho-S6 signaling. As shown here by this Western blotting, if you compare these two lanes here, the sequence is not very logical, we'll have to redo it. Just suggesting what I've showed you here by immuno, that depletion of CD8 T cells leads again to, in the old, to decrease native caspase 3 and increase in phospho-KT and phospho-S6 signaling. Last data in terms of signaling pathway, when we gave inhibitor caspase 3 with the specific inhibitors IP immediately after injury on day 2, we were able to phenocopy what we saw in terms of signaling, suggesting that indeed active caspase 3 is functionally linked to this signaling pathway in the old. And lastly, antagonism of caspase 3 also leads to some improvement in axonal regeneration in the old compared to vehicle. These effects, particularly systemic CXCL13 monoclonal antibody neutralization, which is the initial signaling mechanism just following NFA-kappa-B, have also important regenerative capacity in the spinal cord. This is spinal cord injury, dextrin stress sensory neurons, young, old. This is, see, retraction is much stronger in the old. And antibody in the young, antibody in the old. In this case, no time to discuss this, also I don't know the answer exactly, the antibody in the young has also some effect as opposed to the peripheral regeneration. And this is the summary. Basically, we discovered the presence of CXCR5, CD8 T cells in the aged dorsal root ganglia, and that this signaling pathway restricts axonal regeneration in the peripheral central nervous system. And antibody-mediated inhibition of CXCL13 is able to promote regeneration in the injury and central nervous system. And thanks to the development of these monoclonal therapies in patients, although this is super preliminary initial data, I'm really hopeful that development and better understanding of monoclonal use of monoclonal antibodies to modulate immune function following injury could be really translatable to injury. And these are some of the outstanding questions for the discussion. And thank you very much.